Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today I'm going to look at the early history of amateur rugby league. Traditionally, rugby league below the professional level was known as junior rugby. Today the game is called community rugby league, but the common defining feature was that, by and large, players did not get paid for playing the game and usually it cost them to play it. This led its supporters to claim that amateur rugby league was a more amateur game than rugby union and the other sports which loudly proclaimed their amateur principles, whilst of course at the same time providing their players with non-monetary rewards like gifts or jobs. Although the creation of the Northern Union is often portrayed as a professional breakaway, the 1895 split was widely supported by amateur rugby clubs across the north of England. The first amateur clubs to switch to the Northern Union were the clubs of the Hull and Districts Rugby Union, who voted 33-24 to leave the RFU barely a month after the historic meeting at the George Hotel. And, one by one, local junior clubs and organisations across the north followed the Hull clubs out of Rugby Union. By June 1897, it was reported that there were no rugby union clubs left in Halifax, a town described by a rugby union supporter as a hotbed of northern unionism and bigotry. 3 months later, the Yorkshire Post reported that in Leeds, rugby union football is practically non-existent, but that the Northern Union was at the height of its popularity. The traditional strongholds of junior rugby in the industrial north joined the Northern Union with just as much enthusiasm as the professional clubs. By 1914, there were 210 amateur sides belonging to the Northern Union. The years after World War I were a golden age for amateur rugby league. When the war ended, there were just 42 amateur teams registered with the Northern Union, but 5 years later, this number had increased to 318. But if the 1920s were a boom time for the amateur game, it almost fell off a cliff during the depression of the 1930s. A 1933 RFL report described how there were no amateur clubs anymore in Bradford, no adult amateur clubs in the Dewsbury-Batley area, just two clubs in Huddersfield and a mere seven amateur rugby league clubs in Leeds. It wasn't difficult to find the reasons for this. In 1932, the team from Kinsley, a mining village just south of Wakefield, had debts of £40 and was about to fold because, its secretary explained, employment was bad in the village and players left the club to join others where work was better. Even the cost of buying equipment at this time was sometimes beyond the reach of amateur sides. In 1932, Mr. Ramsden of a club in Halifax appealed to the RFL for help because we can see no way of obtaining shirts. Then there's the question of the ball. The one we at present use is patched all over and the bladder is out of a soccer ball. I feel certain that as a sportsman, you will help us to obtain both ball and shirts. The RFL did help the amateur game by subsidising kit and assisting with the rental of pitches to play on. This also could be a massive stumbling block for clubs, as the Huddersfield and District League pointed out in the 1932 season. Field rents are, as usual, the big drawback. There has not been a great difficulty in getting them, but the excessive rent asked is a very big load for clubs to shoulder. £10 for the season is as little as any owner seems to think of asking. Amateur clubs also faced administrative difficulties. In 1930, a representative of the Dewsbury League said that a major issue was committees losing interest, especially when their team was losing matches. Working men could not be expected to shoulder the financial responsibility for clubs. This financial hardship and a lack of administrative experience were the reasons for a huge number of clubs collapsing in the 1930s. Of the 318 amateur clubs belonging to the RFL in 1925, less than 20% of them were still around in 1935. The situation was slightly different in Cumberland, where there was no professional rugby league until 1945. Here, the amateur game was the focus of local civic pride. For Cumbrian towns like Egremont, Maryport and Whitehaven, playing a professional club in the Challenge Cup was almost as big an event as playing at Wembley itself. This community spirit could also be seen in other amateur clubs. Especially during the miners' industrial disputes of the 1920s, clubs organised fundraising matches for strikers and those locked out by the employers in 1926. In May 1921, local Wigan side Ince All Blacks played a match to raise funds for striking miners, and in October 1926, St Helens sides Gartons Lane and Clock Face played each other in aid of miners' relief funds. Much of the administrative backbone of the amateur game was provided by supporters' clubs and factory teams. supporters' clubs provided the administrative know-how while factory teams benefited from the sports facilities that were increasingly provided by companies. The Yorkshire Federation of Supporters Clubs organised the County Inter Boys League, and supporters' clubs also took the lead in organising local factory or workshop competitions in Batley, Bradford, Hunslet and York. In 1909, 44 sides had entered Huddersfield's workshop competition, while 80 entered Broughton Rangers' 1911 competition in Manchester. Crowds could also be very large. Over 10,000 turned out for the final of the Wakefield Works competition in 1933, and 7,000 spectators saw the 1939 final of the Halifax Workshops tournament. The pitches and other facilities provided by employers in the 1930s were a key factor in the survival of amateur sides. By 1939, over a quarter of all amateur rugby league clubs were factory teams. By 1938, the Hull Works Sports Association had 20 rugby league teams and 5 different competitions. St Helens had numerous work sites, such as United Glass Bottle Manufacturers, Ravenhead Glass and Pilkington Brothers, the town's major employer, who also ran their own league of teams from different factory departments. But whatever their origins, all amateur clubs suffered one common problem: professional clubs. When professional clubs signed a player from an amateur rugby league club, they were supposed to pay that club a signing on fee of £10. This rarely happened. In 1933, the Wakefield local organiser complained to the RFL that he had written 15 letters that season to professional clubs asking them to pay up, but none had even replied. Unlike rugby union's fanatical defence of amateurism, the RFL did not act as a policeman over the amateur game. In rugby league, amateur was a description of the finances of the game, not an indication of social superiority as it was in union. The RFL only drew the line when professional players turned out for amateur clubs. A 1927 cup tie between Askham Miners Welfare and Kirk Sandling West Yorkshire had to be replayed when it revealed that the welfare team included a certain Billy Batten in its ranks, one of the greatest players of his and any other era. On the pitch, amateur players were no less competitive than professionals. In the 1932-33 season, 39 players were sent off in the Wakefield League, a far higher percentage than you could find in the professional game at that time. But the amateur game strongly believed that it had an important role to play in local communities. So, for example, the Wakefield organiser Tony Bland would make sure he made personal contact with young players who had been sent off during a match. In some cases, I write a letter to the boy, and in this case, not only does the boy see it, but also his parents as well. And this does show to them that we are out to do our best in trying to teach the boy to play the game and be a sport. And, may I add, that on more than one occasion it has been said to me that I was doing a much better job than the parsons do. This attitude was especially strong in schools rugby league, which until the 1970s was entirely confined to boys. The fortunes of schools rugby league fluctuated between the wars even more than any other sector of the game. Unlike soccer or rugby union, there wasn't a constant supply of teachers with a rugby league background moving from the grammar schools or universities to teaching schools. Moreover, no private or grammar school would even consider playing rugby league. In 1938, we can estimate that around 320 schools played the game across the north of England. Schools' cup finals were major occasions in rugby league towns. In 1936, 10,000 people turned out for the St Helens Schools Cup Final, while 5,000 did so for the Lee Tournament. Some schools, such as Hunslet Carr in South Leeds, East Hull's Courtney Street and Barrow's Rysdale School, became powerhouses of the game. Between 1920 and 1939, Courtney Street and Hunslet Carr did not lose a game for 10 and 5 seasons respectively, and produced dozens of future professional players, while Rysdale School produced 3 captains of the national team: Bill Burgess, Willie Horn and Phil Jackson. And of course, the game was played informally outside of school. Growing up in Widnes in the 1920s, the future Labour MP Jack Ashley remembered, "We played rugby with a piece of sacking tied in a string in the street. He and his friends collected Oxo coupons to get a real rugby ball to play with, but sadly, the ball was run over a lorry in the first match that it was using." The Oscar-winning actor Peter O'Toole grew up in Hunslet and played as a speedy 12-year-old in a side called Raggedy Arse Rovers, playing against teams with names like Chipshot Wanderers and the Silly Army. Balls are often made with patchworks of leather pieces inflated with a bicycle tyre in a tube, rolled up newspapers or just rags. Occasionally, an unlucky player would be forced to volunteer a shoe. As O'Toole remembered, 2 or 3 matches between teams from various clusters of streets would be played simultaneously. one sometimes found oneself straight into others' matches. Goalposts were a premium. If a pair had already been snatched, often a player's younger brother, our kid, would find himself elected as a post. Kit was irrelevant. A familiar figure with the ball, you supported him. An unfamiliar, you down the bastard. It was a philosophy that perhaps served O'Toole well in Hollywood, but it was certainly not the only lesson that many thousands of others learnt from playing amateur rugby league in the interwar years. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. As I'm sure you know by now, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find the complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, along with the show notes and links for this episode. Until next week, thanks for listening.